From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. New Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby comes into office as the nation is focused on prosecutions in cases of police-related deaths. We ask how she'll approach the issue and what agenda she's setting for the state's attorney's office. Then, how do blows to the head affect the brain? We talk with a professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine about the impact of long-term brain inflammation, which is more widespread than you may think. Plus, Annie is up at the Hippodrome Theater through February 1st. Tom Hall talks with the man who wrote the lyrics of its legendary songs, including Tomorrow, written early in the process.
It really gave the audience an opportunity to find that, gave us actually as authors an opportunity to know where we were going with the show.
Now, news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. It's been less than 3 weeks since Marilyn Mosby was sworn in as Baltimore City State's attorney, but she and her office have generated headlines almost every day since. Her path to office was clear after she defeated Greg Bernstein in the Democratic primary last June. Her resume includes 5 years as an assistant state's attorney, mostly under former state's attorney Pat Jessamy, followed by work as a civil litigator. And Marilyn Mosby is with me in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Sheila.
Your primary campaign was pretty much over by the time Michael Brown, an unarmed black man, was shot by police in Ferguson, Missouri, and the protests that followed. You spoke at your investiture about growing up in a family of police officers and also about the obligation of every officer to protect the public. How will you approach cases in which suspects are injured by police?
Well, I can tell you that right now, it's not just in Baltimore City, it's all across the country. You just touched on it. There's a disconnect between law enforcement and our communities. I feel that it's incumbent as the administrator of the criminal justice system to be able to break down those barriers of distrust between communities and law enforcement. So from that perspective, that's what I intend to do. I recently revealed my organizational structure. My top priority are going to be violent repeat offenders. And I also have included an organizational structure which has a community affairs division. So we're starting to break down those barriers of distrust, community engagement, and making violent repeat offenders the top of my list. And when it comes to police officers, it's about justice. So, you know, a majority of police officers are risking their lives day in and day out. I can tell you from personal experience coming from 5 generations of police officers, it's about applying justice fairly and equally, you know, to those with or without a badge. And that's what I intend to do.
There were at least 2 cases in recent years in Baltimore of suspects dying in police custody. Anthony Anderson in September 2012, Tyrone West in July 2013. Just this week, Tyrone West's aunt, Diane Butler, called in to Dan Roderick's show talking about what her family, the pain her family still feels. In those cases, your predecessor decided not to prosecute police. In the Ferguson and the chokehold Eric Garner case in Staten Island, it was a grand jury decision. Do you see which of those approaches do you think is a better way?
Well, what I can say in that particular instance in which you're referencing, unfortunately, one of the problems in the Tyrone West case was there was a lack of transparency. And I can guarantee, you know, having been a victim of crime, my cousin who grew up with me like a brother was actually killed right outside my home when I was about 14 years old. So understanding and having gone through that experience, I know how important it is to make families a part of the process. And I can tell you that in the case of the Tyrone West case, they felt disconnected. They felt re-victimized because nobody had really communicated with them. They didn't know how their family and their loved one was killed for over 9 months. The mayor had to actually issue a letter asking that the autopsy report be released and that there be some sort of resolve for that family. What I can tell you that as the administrator operator of the criminal justice system, having the experiences that I've had, transparency is a top priority for me. So making people a part of the process, that's what I intend to do.
You mentioned violent repeat offenders will be your priority. We talked about this during your primary campaign. Also, that is what Greg Bernstein, your predecessor, said was his priority. Take us deeper into what you're going to do differently.
Absolutely. I've been traveling all across the country, actually, to various district attorney's offices to see what best practices we can employ right here in Baltimore. And I can tell you that I've gone to Manhattan, I've gone to Brooklyn, LA, Atlanta, and there was one particular sort of unit that really stuck out. Cyrus Vance is doing something really phenomenal in Manhattan. It's called a criminal strategies unit. It's where you take large data. You know, everybody kind of works within their silos. You have the Baltimore City Police Department, the state police, you have pretrial, you have DOC, and everybody has their own collection of data. Well, I'm going to create a unit where you centralize that information and you start to build cases against habitual offenders. And I've already recruited a really phenomenal young man who was a former prosecutor, Joshua Rosenblatt, who was also a police detective. He's going to be leading that unit. We're really excited about it. This is like the nervous system. It's an investigative unit where you provide that information to prosecutors at the very beginning, at the outset, so they're not just looking at a case and saying, oh, I'm looking at their record, but they have a context for the individual. So I'm really excited about that. I've revealed that organizational structure. I have a dynamic team that is in place. I've been able to put this organizational structure in place in a matter of 7 days. I'm really, really excited about it. And I think that it's going to really help us focus on these individuals who time and time again are the small number of individuals who wreak havoc in our communities.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Kasten. We're speaking with Marilyn Mosby, Baltimore's new state's attorney. The Baltimore Sun, you mentioned reorganization. The Baltimore Sun and the City Paper have both used the word purge to describe your firing several prosecutors, including at least a couple who were in the midst of trials, which is your right. They are at-will employees. How many prosecutors have you dismissed?
Well, what I can tell you is I'm not going to talk about personnel issues, but with any administration, there's change. It happens when football teams change coaches. It happens when companies, large and small, merge. It certainly happens when there's new elected officials. I've been able to get into office and implement an organizational structure. I can tell you that I have a new leadership team, and everybody in the office is really excited about it. You know, I intentionally left some internal vacancies for people to be able to promote internally and for people to feel like there's an opportunity for growth and leadership. And I can tell you that I have been swamped by the number of applications for those positions within the office. I know from experience, having worked in the state's attorney's office for more than 5 years, I actually worked there for approximately 7, that the prosecutors in the state's attorney's office are the best prosecutors in the country. And having gone all across the country on my own dime to see what best practices we could employ, I can say firsthand that I work with some of the top and most brightest and best prosecutors in the country, and I'm excited, you know, to just be able to lead them.
What are the circumstances that call for a prosecutor being dismissed in the middle of a trial?
As I stated before, the one thing I can't get into the personnel issues legally.
No, but I'm asking the policy question of whether there's not a concern when a prosecutor is in the middle of a trial.
And again, I can't get into the specifics of a personnel action, but what I can tell you is that any allegations, I want to ensure the public and the crime victims that we represent that all cases will be handled with professionalism and given the attention they deserve. And I can tell you that that's been done.
Okay, but and perhaps the Baltimore Sun misreported it. They talked about a prosecutor who was prosecuting in the morning and didn't come back after lunch because the defense attorneys were told she was
Sheila, as I stated to you before.
And I'm not
legally
asking you to discuss a particular case. I'm asking what the situation would be as a policy matter.
And I can't tell you any situation because legally I cannot do that. I cannot discuss and I will not discuss personnel issues. But as I indicated, I will ensure the public and the crime victims that we represent that all cases will be handled with professionalism and given the attention they deserve, as I stated.
Okay. You just talked a few minutes ago about transparency.
Absolutely.
And but I don't feel like I have an understanding.
Legally, I cannot talk about personnel issues.
You so cannot I'm not talk sure. about personnel
I
cases.
I cannot tell you about the circumstances surrounding
for
any
example,
personnel issues.
For example, I asked you a few minutes ago how many. I don't think that would be a personnel matter to tell me how many
it
prosecutors.
Is. It is.
Out of your staff of 400, how much change there is. You can't discuss that.
We indicated that prior to coming on the show, and I'm indicating it to you right now as well.
Okay.
I'm not going to discuss
You mentioned earlier the community aspect
yes.
of deploying, and your predecessor, Greg Bernstein, as you pointed out often during the campaign, had changed that so that you didn't have the community
no,
liaisons.
I don't know. I don't understand your question.
I haven't gotten to the question
no.
yet. I'm sorry. I'm not being as precise as I should be. I'm trying to understand what you're doing about getting the community involved.
I've created a community affairs division. I've streamlined the prosecutor's responsibilities so that we're focusing on violent repeat offenders. And the community affairs division actually focuses on community engagement, victim witness services, and crime control and prevention. So there will be a number of initiatives that will come out of the crime control and prevention unit. I've also already re-implemented the community liaisons. You'll note, I know that you've followed the campaign pretty closely. And I can tell you that my predecessor, when he came into office, he fired all of the community liaisons,
right.
which were the face of the office into the community. And one of the things that I thought was a problem and exacerbated distrust, well, I've already hired three additional community liaisons, and I'm looking to increase that to about 9. So in a matter of 2 weeks, I've been able to unveil my organizational structure, my leadership team, and implement everything that I said that I would. These three community liaisons are once again in the community involved in encouraging court watch programs. They're encouraging, you know, community days in court. They're attending community association meetings. Again, as the administrator of the criminal justice system, it's important for me to be able to break down those barriers of distrust if that's the only thing that prevents us from getting the really bad guys off the streets, the violent repeat offenders. And that's what I've done in a matter of 3 weeks.
And will you change the organization into the three, as I understand it, Bernstein had organized prosecutors in three geographic areas.
He had a community prosecution model in
uh-huh.
which they were broken down into zones
yeah.
based on geography, and that has nothing to do with the community liaisons. That has to do with the implementation of the prosecutorial unit. And what I can tell you is that I've essentially combined that unit. It's now the felony trial division. It is still broken down into geographic zones, but there are two tiers within those zones, which are your violent crimes division and your general crimes division. And rather than have three division chiefs and 9 team captains, we now have 1 division chief and 3 team captains.
Got it. We're out of time. I really appreciate your coming in to talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Marilyn Mosby. She's Baltimore's new state's attorney. We have more information on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, just ahead, rethinking brain damage. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Marilyn Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Now we're going to talk about the human brain and how fragile it is. You may recall that last Friday we spoke with Dr. Vasilis Koliatsos, professor of pathology, neurology, and psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, about the tiny physical wounds or lesions that show up in the brain after a bomb blast, even when that blast doesn't kill a soldier on the battlefield. Dr. Koliatsos told us his team examined autopsies that showed a unique pattern in the brains of veterans exposed to blasts, and then went on to die of other causes years later. He said that research helps explain the shell shock seen in soldiers returning from World War I a century ago. Now, from researchers at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, we get another set of insights into how the brain reacts to traumatic injury. and whether science has been paying too little attention to the impact of inflammation in the brain. Joining us by phone is Dr. Alan Faden, a neurologist and professor of anesthesiology. He and his colleague David Lohn, assistant professor of anesthesiology, published research on this issue last week. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Dr. Faden, this latest paper builds on other research you've published recently about traumatic brain injury in animals. What is the conclusion you think the public should understand about your work?
Well, this paper critically assesses both animal experimentation, including our own, and human work for many years, trying to understand what happens to the human brain after injury. And much of the work historically has focused on traumatic brain injury as an acute event. That is to say, something happens at one point in time that causes immediate or almost immediate brain damage, and then the person is left with the consequences of that damage, either to recover or to suffer disabilities. And what has been clear for a significant period of time, although not well recognized by practitioners, either neurologists or neurosurgeons, is that traumatic brain injury can cause a progressive response in the brain. That is to say, the brain degenerates over time, loses nerve cells and tissue that may go on for months or years after injury. And what's also important is the recognition, again, first observed many years ago but not believed to be important, and now recognized increasingly both in animals and humans, including living humans, that brain trauma can cause a long-standing, sometimes even permanent, inflammation in the brain, and that inflammation is associated with progressive loss of nerve cells in critical brain regions over many months or years. So that is, I think, the new observations coming from many sources now, and moreover, that inflammation appears to be a very significant and under-recognized part of that process. And very importantly, at least experimentally, that chronic inflammation can be treated, and animals can be made to recover very substantially after a serious brain injury, even weeks or months after the insult.
And I want to ask you more about treatment, but I first want to make sure that I'm understanding. Since brain inflammation occurs over this long period of time, how do researchers spot it and factor it in so you can reach conclusions about it?
Well, historically, it was observed in autopsy cases. So many years ago, it was observed in autopsies from patients who died many years after a serious head injury that inflammatory cells were found to be widespread in the brain. And until recently, that was considered an epiphenomenon. That's to say, something that occurred but probably wasn't important in the injury process. More recently, it's been observed in a much larger series of human autopsies that came out of a collaboration between Scotland and the University of Pennsylvania that a very substantial percentage of individuals with prior head injury, moderate or severe, have sustained inflammation many years later. Also recently, people have used advanced brain imaging techniques with a very specific compound that can measure inflammation in the living brain. And what they observed and what was reported in a major journal several years ago and recently replicated in athletes, actually, was that prior history of head injury was associated with chronic inflammation in the brain as long as 17 years later, and not only at the site of injury, but actually very widespread in the brain and affecting critical structures that are associated with cognition and memory.
And you just mentioned football players or athletes. What kind of injuries are we talking about here?
Well, surprisingly, the data increasingly are suggesting that it doesn't even take concussion necessarily to cause injuries. Information had come out in boxers subjected to repeated brain injuries, and more recently, professional athletes in high-contact sports like American pro football, who may have sustained many prior concussions, can have a long-standing disorder, which people have termed chronic traumatic encephalopathy, but a disorder that in which there is severe brain degeneration and psychiatric and neurological symptoms, including suicide and dementia. And but increasingly, it's been recognized both by brain imaging studies and neuropsychological types of investigations that simply exposure to practice in football with repeated levels of subconcussion hits, which is to say levels of exposure that don't cause a change in brain physiology or brain function that the person recognizes, but still over time, with hundreds and thousands of such hits, one might also show levels of brain damage. Now, that work is at a very early stage, and one can argue or debate whether it's really true, but it's very suggestive. That is to say, people have shown that football players who have not even been on the first team, that is to say, more scrub players even, but anybody playing playing football in this one study of college athletes demonstrated smaller areas of the brain called hippocampus, which is where we make memories, and it was found in all football players compared to people that didn't play football, and it was more severe in those that had prior concussion but was still apparent in those that had not. There have also been studies that have looked at neuropsychological profiles from the beginning of a season to the end of a season and suggested, again, that not only the starters but even other players on the team might have changes in neuropsychological performance from the beginning to the end of a season, again suggesting that exposure to repeated hits, even if they do not lead to concussion, may cause problems. And again, it's controversial, it's early, but what's not controversial is the fact that repeated concussion can cause significant disabilities later on. And increasingly, it's becoming clear that inflammation in the brain, at least certainly experimentally with concussion and repeated concussion, begins to mimic exactly what happens after a more severe brain injury.
That's neurologist and professor of anesthesiology, Dr. Alan Faden, here on Maryland Morning, 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast, and we're talking about the research he published with David Lone about the impact of inflammation after even mild traumatic brain injury. We talked about athletes. Does your research have implications for the elderly who take a fall?
Absolutely, and very important. In fact, it's a major focus of my lab's work. David Lone specifically is funded by NIH to study specifically traumatic injuries experimentally in aged animals, and we've published some work on this. It's well known that head injury in older individuals is more severe as a rule, okay? That the consequences are worse. It's quite clear in experimental animals, and we've published this, that if you produce the same injury in a juvenile animal and an elderly animal, the lesion size, that is to say, the destruction, is four times larger in the older animal than the younger animal. And the enzyme system that I mentioned, this free radical generating system called NOX2, is markedly enhanced in elderly animals as it is compared to younger animals, and is associated with a greater degree of inflammation in the elderly brain and a greater degree of cell loss in the elderly brain. And our center, the so-called PATEC Center, is intending to look at that in humans specifically.
So there may be a way of addressing that outsized inflammatory response in an older brain.
Exactly. And remember that the average person, one out of three individuals over the age of 65 will have a significant fall in the next year. And if one has fallen once, the probability is one out of two in the following year. So this is an enormous problem. Many of them sustained brain injuries. Many sustained hip fractures. And we're studying both brain injuries and hip fractures in this center.
You mentioned this opens the door to treatment. What kind of treatment? How might this work?
Well, what has occurred is that one has investigated not only the fact that inflammation occurs, but what mechanisms, what are the responsible chemical pathways that are responsible for initiating that. In the first paper we published about 2 years ago, we demonstrated that a molecular treatment strategy that shut down that pathway could be administered to animals even 1 month after a rather severe brain injury, in which we had the same kinds of information as we have in humans. We had very high-field MRI scans on the animals and cognitive performance and so on, and the animals were randomly assigned to treatment with just a vehicle, which was a salt water or a placebo, and the treatment. And the animals treated 1 month after injury showed remarkable recovery of cognitive performance and motor performance over time. Their brain lesions, or the hole in the brain that they had, stopped progressing, in contrast to the control animals, in which the brains continued to degenerate. More recently, we showed that structured exercise in animals, but only if done long after the trauma, can also shut down the same inflammatory pathway and improve recovery.
What kind of exercise?
Well, this is in rodents, where you put them on a running wheel and they run enormous distances. They run a number of miles per evening. And we instituted that 5 weeks after brain injury, and the animals recovered very substantially. They were actually able to generate new nerve cells in the brain regions responsible for cognitive performance. And so, and this mimicked what we saw with this molecular strategy, and it targeted the same pathway, this free radical generating pathway. Ironically and interestingly, early initiation of exercise made inflammation in the brain worse after trauma. So that's something to be noted also.
One last thing before I let you go.
Mm-hmm.
These mice running miles, you're talking about regular measured miles on their little legs? I mean, mm-hmm. It would be the equivalent of humans running marathons.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's very interesting. The animals are addicted to exercise more than our marathon runners. And in fact, some have said if you have a rodent or pest problem in your house, put a running wheel out and you'll collect all of the animals.
Because they love it.
They love it.
That's so interesting. Thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome.
Dr. Alan Faden is neurologist and professor of anesthesiology at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He worked with assistant professor of anesthesiology David Lone on this research. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, Annie's Lyricist. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. One of the world's most popular and enduring musicals is back at the Hippodrome Theater in Baltimore this week and next. Annie exploded on Broadway in 1977. Thomas Meehan wrote the book, Charles Strauss wrote the music, and my guest today wrote the lyrics and directed the original Broadway production and the national touring production that's here in Charm City. He has also directed many other productions of this iconic musical masterpiece around the globe. Martin Charnin has a distinguished career in theater, film, and television that spans nearly 60 years. Last November, I caught up with Mr. Charnin from his home in Westchester County, New York. Mr. Charnin, welcome to Maryland Morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
So take us back to the day, if you would, that you wrote Tomorrow, one of many, many great songs in this show. Did you have the melody in your head already? Had Charles Strauss given you a tune?
Do you remember when the
phrase, the sun will come up tomorrow, popped into your head?
Well, Charles and I had a very, very kind of neat collaboration. I had previously collaborated with a lot of people, including Richard Rodgers, and wrote two shows with Dick. When Richard Rodgers and I wrote, he worked in a very strikingly different fashion than Charles and I worked together. I would bring a lyric to Dick, and he would sort of say, go have a cup of coffee and come back in about 40 minutes or so. And I would do that and then return, and Rogers would have already finished the melody. And we would then, of course, work on it together to see how it would work. With Charles, however, we were young, and we were brazen, and we were not ashamed of making mistakes in front of one another. So we sort of collaborated on the entire score for Annie while sitting in the room at the same time. He wasn't afraid to play some clinkers on the piano, and I wasn't afraid to write a silly line that didn't rhyme and made no sense. And so all of the songs, I would say, with maybe one or two exceptions, and I can't even remember what they were literally written together. We, of course, had to work with the text and figure out where and where the song was going to go in the scene and what, indeed, it was meant to accomplish. Tomorrow was early, really, really early, because one of the things that that we discovered was that when you have a heroine, a hero, heroine, whatever, and you want to get their point of view across early, you want to be able to work from that position. And tomorrow was early because it really gave the audience an opportunity to find that, gave us, actually, as authors, an opportunity to know where we were going with the show. And having defined her in that song, I think it was very important and responsible for being the touchstone for a lot of the other songs in the show.
Yeah, and of course, the great optimism, that incredible outlook
right.
on life that you hear from her in Tomorrow is one of the things I think that so many people relate to in this show. But, you know, when you look at the song list for this show, Maybe, Hard Knock Life, NYC, Easy Street, it's amazing to me the number of hits that are in this show. Were some of them, which of those were sort of the easiest ones to do, and which are the ones that you really sweat bullets about?
Well, realistically, I would be foolish to say that you didn't sweat bullets about all of them. They don't come drippingly off your pen or off the keyboard the way they do in movies. In movies, somebody, the composer and the lyricist sit down, and in about 30 seconds, bang,
right.
You know, they've written the iconic song or the song that becomes the instant number one chart topper. Every one of these songs comes from the book. Once I think Shelton Harnick was asked the question, what comes first, the music or the lyrics? And his answer was the book. And in truth,
and of course, in theater terms, we should remind folks that the book refers to the script of the musical.
The script, the libretto. And
mm-hmm.
once that's been solved, or at least once you're on the road to knowing where you have to go, you're then in a position to, first of all, to rob it blind. I mean, that's what a good lyric writer always does. You let the librettist do the work, put the thing down on paper, and then you find out how you can take part of the scene that he's written and turn it into a song. That means also that you're in a position to move the plot and not become redundant, so that the song does not really reiterate the thing that you've already heard on the stage or what you're going to hear. The songs take you from page 22 to page 27, and they do it musically. Which is really what a musical is all about. It's really about the music and the entertainment factor that you can bring to the stage.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. My guest this morning, Martin Charnin, a Broadway legend. He's the lyricist for the music for Annie. He's also the director of the touring production that is here at the Hippodrome Theater in Baltimore. You know, it's always interesting to me how things get tweaked after you'd, written them and
mm-hmm.
conceived the show. But for example, the first tune in the show, when Annie sings Maybe, and that's one of those songs that just saying the title brings me to tears. It's such a beautiful song.
Thank you.
But it wasn't originally the thing you thought you would open with. You were going to start with Hard Knock Life.
Right.
Why did you make
that
change?
At the very beginning of the work, when we were in previews, or when we were up at Goodspeed, at the Goodspeed Opera House doing the first tryout of the show, Hard Knock opened the show, and it was the sort of a production number that had a little pizzazz to it. It had a wonderful vamp and I think an iconic melody. And maybe followed it. Maybe it was the second song in the show. It's a lullaby. Maybe it's a lullaby, basically, that Annie sings to another one of the kids. But it also really defines her search. And we discovered that the audience was interested, but not on the edge of their seat, knowing about all of the shows. If the show had maybe had a different title, if it wasn't specifically a title like Annie, then maybe Hard Knock would have worked. And so in, I think, the third week of performances, we made the switch, and we were able to identify her craving, her journey. We wanted the audience to know what it was that she was all about and what she was looking for. And the minute that that happened, I'll never forget this, the minute that we made that switch, the audience was literally on the edge of their seats, and it was the first night that we ever got a standing ovation.
Martin Charnin, the lyricist and director of Annie, it's here at the Hippodrome Theater. Mr. Charnin, thank you so much, not only for your time today, but for giving us this terrific musical piece. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and hope everybody has a good time there.
Martin Charnin, we spoke last November with Charles Strauss. He wrote the songs to the legendary musical Annie. You can catch Annie at the Hippodrome Theater in Baltimore until February 1st. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning for all the details. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein
and Catherine Sway.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1648, Margaret Brent, a landowner and Lord Baltimore's attorney, appeared before the General Assembly seeking the right to vote. The first time recorded in the American colonies that a woman sought suffrage, Brent was denied. Women in Maryland, as in other states, got the right to vote when the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920. Thanks for listening. We're back Friday.